General Organic Biochemistry, a survey. In this unit, we're going to take up the study of alcohols and ethers and related compounds. What is this term proof all about when referring to alcoholic beverages? Why does some alcohols change to vinegar? How does a breathalyzer work? What makes skunks smell so bad? Is ether still a good anesthesia to use? We're going to start with a study of alcohols, and in our study of alcohols, we'll talk about some important terms. We'll go through the structure and properties of alcohols. We will talk about IUPAC, or systematic nomenclature, common nomenclature, and we will talk about some of the reactions of alcohols. Starting with important terms. First, let's talk about the R group. Now, what we're talking about here is a way to talk about any alkyl group and refer to it as R. So an R group is an alkane with one of its hydrogens replaced by something else, maybe by an OH, maybe by a bromine, maybe by a chlorine. For example, if we have an ROH, we're talking about something that is attached to an OH, an alkyl group. We're talking about an alkane in which one of its hydrogens has been replaced by an OH. And it could be any one of a number of alkane groups there that is attached to the OH. Or we could have an RBR, in which we have an alkane that's attached to something else, in this case, bromine. It lost a hydrogen, and the hydrogen was replaced by a bromine, like this one. And it could be any one of a number of different alkanes that this has happened to. Now, azeotropes. An azeotrope is a constant boiling mixture. Well, that may at first say, okay, so, well, you see, mixtures very often have several boiling points. They start out boiling at one temperature until one part of the mixture boils off. Then they shift and boil at another temperature until another part of the mixture boils off, and so forth. But not azeotropes. Azeotropes are constant boiling mixtures, and they're important. An example of one, and it's a classic, is a mixture of 95% volume-volume alcohol and water. And that's ethyl alcohol. We'll talk about what ethyl alcohol is later. And what it is you cannot separate this solution of alcohol and water by boiling, because it won't allow the alcohol to come off and then the temperature change and the water to come off like most mixtures do. Instead, the whole thing boils off at the same temperature together. But it has to be a very specific combination. Halide. A halide is a compound in which an R group is bonded to a halogen. An R group is bonded to a halogen. For example, here is an ethyl group that's bonded to a chlorine. Or you can have an isopropyl group bonded to a bromine. Or how about here, a cyclohexyl group bonded to a fluorine. And this is called a halide. So a halide, in this case, we've shown you three. It's an alkyl group or an R group attached to a halogen. Let's look at the structure and properties of alcohols now. Alcohols have a basic structure, ROH, or I don't even have to put the dash in there. We just know that the R group is bonded to the oxygen, which is bonded to the hydrogen. And it's bonded like this. Very much like water. Remember, water looks like this. Well, the alcohol looks very much the same. The bond angles might be a little different, but we're not going to worry about those right now. And there is a classification of alcohols that you need to know. The primary alcohols have the OH attached to a first-degree carbon. The OH is attached to a first-degree carbon. You remember first-degree carbons. A secondary alcohol has the OH attached to a secondary carbon, or a second-degree carbon. The OH is attached to a second-degree carbon. And tertiary alcohols? Well, it is as you expect. The OH is attached to a tertiary carbon, or a third-degree carbon. Classify these. Here's this one. Now, what's the OH attached to? Well, it's attached to a primary carbon, or a first-degree carbon, sure. Well, how about here? What's the OH attached to? And it's attached to a secondary or a second-degree carbon. Second-degree carbon. It's attached to a carbon that's attached to two other carbons. What about this one? It's also secondary, yes, because the OH is attached to a carbon attached to two other carbons. Well, try this one. That's right. It is a tertiary carbon. It's a tertiary alcohol. It's a tertiary alcohol because the OH is attached to a third-degree carbon. Got the idea? We have a primary alcohol here, two secondary alcohols here, and a tertiary alcohol. Now the properties. Alcohols are very soluble in water. They are very soluble in water. Until you get to the alcohols that have a huge number of carbons, then they're not so soluble in water. But if you're talking about the smaller alcohols, the ones you run into more frequently, they are very soluble in water. And they are insoluble in nonpolar solvents, like gasoline and oils and things of that type. Unless, of course, they're the large alcohols. They have higher boiling points than alkanes. Wait a minute. Why would alcohols have higher boiling points than alkanes? Well, we're going to get to that in just a minute. Alcohols are good solvents for polar compounds. A lot of things that will dissolve in water will dissolve in alcohols too. And alcohols themselves will dissolve in water. And as I talked to you about a moment ago, alcohols easily form azeotropes. Very easily form constant boiling mixtures. Now the question is why? Well, let's consider ethyl alcohol. Here's ethyl alcohol. See its structure, that oxygen is somewhat polar, the oxygen is somewhat polar negative, the hydrogen is somewhat positive, that ethyl group is somewhat positive. Along comes another alcohol, and what happens? It hydrogen bonds. That's right, it hydrogen bonds. Along comes another one, and oh, it hydrogen bonds too. You have to think hydrogen bonding when you see a hydrogen attached to an oxygen. And that explains the higher boiling points. Yes, exactly that's why the things boil at higher temperatures, because the alcohols are bonded to each other by hydrogen bonds. So when you're trying to boil it off, you're having to break up those hydrogen bonds in order to get the alcohol molecules to come off as a gas. Now think about solubility in water. Oh, yes. What is it? It's hydrogen bonding again, isn't it? And these things form these strong bonds between the alcohol and the water. And that's why the alcohols tend to form azeotropes. Now, what's this term proof? You think about proof when you think about alcohols, alcoholic beverages, wines, liquors, beers, things of that type. Well, in the United States, proof is defined as twice the percentage volume alcohol. But that's not really the full story about it. You really ought to go look it up. Its historical basis has to do with the quantity of alcohol that must be available to allow gunpowder saturated with the alcohol to burn when you put a match to it. If you take a pile of gunpowder and you pour some alcohol on it and you strike a match to it, it might not burn. It depends on how much water is in the alcohol. The alcohol has to be at least 50% alcohol, or at least that's pretty generally the idea, for it to be able to burn. And that's why 50% alcohol in the United States is referred to as 100 proof. Want more information about it? It's a little more complex than what I'm giving you. Well, you might check out Wikipedia. That has a good explanation of it. Nomenclature. How do we name alcohols? Well, after all the work you've done naming alkanes and alkenes and alkynes and cyclics, it's not hard. What you do is you name the alkane, but you drop the E and replace it with OL. And you make sure that the OH is attached to a carbon in the parent chain. You make sure the OH is attached to a carbon in the parent chain. You give the carbon the OH is attached to the lowest possible number. Give the carbon the OH is attached to the lowest possible number. All right, here we go. This. Okay, what's the alkane? One carbon alkane is methane. Drop the E and replace with OL, and what do you have? Methanol. Methanol. All right, look at this one. Now, what is the alkane? It's three carbons. The alkane is propane. Sure. But on which carbon is the OH attached? Well, the carbon that the OH is attached is going to have to be given the lowest possible number. And since it's on the end, it could be given the number 1, couldn't it? So this is 1-propanol. 1-propanol. Do you see? What is this one? Well, it's a 3-carbon alcohol, so it's from propane. We drop the E and use OL. But which carbon is the OH attached to? Yeah, it's attached to carbon number 2, isn't it? So this is 2-propanol. 2-propanol. Let's look at common nomenclature. To name things in common nomenclature, what you do is you name the R group and you add the word alcohol. You name the R group and you add the word alcohol. So you're going to use terms like isopropyl and secondary butyl and normal propyl and ethyl and things of that type. Here we go. Now, what would you call this one? What's the R group? Well, the R group is methyl. So this is methyl alcohol. Now what's the R group here? Well, it's a straight chain of 3 carbons. And we call that, remember, normal propyl or N-propyl. So this is called N-propyl alcohol. What is this one? What is that R group called? Yeah, whatever it's stuck onto is stuck onto the middle carbon. That is called isopropyl alcohol. Isopropyl alcohol. Got the idea? Try this one. 4 carbons. On which carbon is the OH? This is secondary butyl alcohol. Sometimes we just shorten it to sec butyl alcohol. What's this? Well, it doesn't look quite the same, does it? But the OH, oh, look where the OH is attached. It's attached to the second carbon. So this is called sec butyl alcohol or secondary butyl alcohol. Sure. I wonder if you remember this alkyl group. See that? Do you remember? Oh, it's making you dust the cobwebs off from the last unit, isn't it? What is this called? This is called isobutyl alcohol. Isobutyl alcohol. Yeah, common nomenclature. But we're not done. There's an archaic nomenclature, and there are three alcohols whose archaic names you must learn. This one right here, which you know of, methanol or methyl alcohol, but you need to know, particularly in the health professions, that that is called wood alcohol. It's from the distillation of wood. And this one, which you know as ethanol or ethyl alcohol, the archaic name is grain alcohol. Grain alcohol. And this one? Oh, I bet you remember it. What is it called? If you gave it the common name, it would be isopropyl alcohol. So you know that that's rubbing alcohol, don't you? So learn these three archaic names and know the formulas. And you should be able then to know what other names they go by. Now, what if we have more than one OH group? There are a number of cases in which this can happen, but there are two that you must know. Here is one, CH2OH, CH2OH. This one is called ethylene glycol or antifreeze. Ethylene glycol or antifreeze. You must know this. Why? Because it has a sweet taste and is very poisonous. If your antifreeze leaks from your car, for goodness sake, watch the children and watch the animals that they don't get to that dripping antifreeze because they love the taste of it, and it is extremely poisonous. So get that mopped up fast. There's another one. Looks very similar except that it's a carbon longer. This is called glycerol or glycerin. Glycerol or glycerin. Now, glycerol or glycerin, unlike antifreeze, has a somewhat sweet taste, not as sweet as antifreeze probably. I don't know. I've never tasted antifreeze. But the neat thing is the glycerol or glycerin is not toxic. So it is used in a lot of foodstuffs and medicines. Athletes like to drink a solution of glycerol or glycerin because it helps their cells retain fluid, which I understand is a desirable situation. Now, think about the two kinds of alcohols. How would the boiling points of these two alcohols compare? Well, look. Now, you've got the first alcohol has two OH groups. The second alcohol has only one OH group. Which alcohol will have the higher boiling point and why? And the answer is, this one is much higher. This is ethylene glycol. And it is much, much higher boiling point than ethyl alcohol. Why? Because it can form so many more hydrogen bonds. So many more hydrogen bonds. And you will particularly note that those alcohols that have multiple OH groups are thick. They are very, very thick and syrupy-like, unlike the regular alcohols or the one-carbon alcohols. Let's talk about reactions. There are many reactions that alcohols undergo, but oh, there's only one that you need to know. And that reaction is oxidation. Let's start with primary alcohols and see how they undergo oxidation. Primary alcohols react with oxidizing agents to produce acids. Now, there are any number of oxidizing agents that will work, and oxygen in the air is an example. Oxygen in the air will react slowly with first-degree alcohols, or primary alcohols, and will react like this. Here you have ethyl alcohol plus oxygen. That's oxygen can be from the air, and it produces this compound. This, folks, is the conversion of wine to vinegar. Yeah. You see, if wine is exposed to the air too much, it will react with the oxygen in the air, and it will produce vinegar. That's right. Another oxidizing agent that is commonly used in chemistry is potassium permanganate. Now, potassium permanganate reacts fast with first-degree alcohols. And it reacts like this. The first-degree alcohol in the presence of potassium permanganate produces an acid. Here's another first-degree alcohol with potassium permanganate. It also produced an acid. Very, very rapid reaction. Unlike the reaction with air, which is much, much slower. A practical use of this oxidation business of primary alcohols is the ease with which ethyl alcohol is oxidized. And you see, if you take ethyl alcohol and you drink it, and then you exhale, your breath will contain some of the alcohol. Therefore, we can use that to make a breathalyzer. And our ethyl alcohol will react with potassium dichromate to produce an acid and the chromic ion. And what we see is the orange-red potassium dichromate converting to the yellow chromic ion. And the extent to which that occurs can be related to the amount of alcohol a person has in their blood. Secondary alcohols also undergo these reactions, but with not the same products. For example, second-degree alcohols, upon oxidation, will produce ketones. And we're going to look at this using potassium permanganate, for example. If we take isopropyl alcohol and treat it with potassium permanganate, and quite frankly, we have to do it in an acid medium, we're going to produce a ketone. And we will talk later about the structure of ketones and the properties of ketones. But learn this reaction. Second-degree alcohols produce ketones. What about third-degree alcohols or tertiary alcohols? Well, third-degree alcohols really are not reactive in these circumstances. So if we were to take a third-degree alcohol, like tertiary butanol, and treat it with potassium permanganate, we would get, for our practical purposes, no reaction. All right, think you've got those straight now? Primary alcohols produce acids. Secondary alcohols produce ketones. And tertiary alcohols do not undergo the reaction. Let's try a variety of these. Let's consider this alcohol. Now, if we're going to talk about the reaction of this alcohol with something like potassium permanganate, which is an oxidizing agent, we have to know what degree alcohol we're talking about. And what degree alcohol is this one? This is a third degree alcohol, isn't it? Because this carbon right here is attached to three other carbons. So what happens when you put a third degree alcohol with a strong oxidizing agent or with an oxidizing agent at all? The answer is you get no reaction. No reaction for our purposes. All right, let's try another one. Well, here's an alcohol. Now, what degree alcohol is this? This carbon right here, which is attached to the OH, is attached to two other carbons. So when you put it with an oxidizing agent, maybe potassium dichromate, this is going to react to produce what? Can you write it before I do? That's right. It's going to produce a ketone. Let's try another. Oh, here's one. Now, what degree alcohol is this right here? What degree is that right there? And the answer is it's second degree, isn't it? Sure. So if you take this and put it with an oxidizing agent, such as potassium permanganate, you're going to get, let's see if I can draw a hexagon here without making too big a mess out of it. Well, I've drawn better, but I've certainly drawn worse, too. It's going to give you a ketone, just like we had up here. This is a ketone, and this is a ketone. And we will study the class of ketones a little later. Here's another one. Now, what kind of an alcohol is this? That's right, it's a first degree alcohol. And if we put it with something like potassium dichromate, what are we going to produce? Do you remember? Well, we're going to produce this. Now, what you have to do right here, this carbon is attached to the OH. So when you write this, you have to remember that it gets rid of those hydrogens and it produces COOH, which is an acid. All right, we'll give you plenty of opportunities to practice this. Phenols are another class of compounds, and they have the basic structure shown here. Now, what you see is a benzene ring with an OH attached. However, they are not alcohols. They are phenols. They look somewhat like alcohols, yes, but no, their properties are significantly different, that they have their own classification. Let's look at nomenclature, and here's the first one. Now, this is a bromine attached to a phenol. And where is it attached? Remember your nomenclature when you have two groups attached to an aromatic ring? That's right. This is called meta-bromophenol. Meta-bromophenol. And most of the nomenclature you're going to see is going to be very straightforward like that. However, there are, however, three that we have to deal with specifically. This is one of them, and it is called orthocresol. Now, orthocresol is a name that has historical significance, and so we use the historical name, so you need to learn it. However, there is also metacresol. And what do you think this would be called? Sure, paracresol. Orthocresol, metacresol, and paracresol. These three are important for you to know, so just put them on your flashcards, name on one side, structure on the other, carry them around with you, and learn these. The properties of phenols. Well, you could probably do some predicting. The properties are very similar to alcohols, with one notable exception, and that is acidity. Phenols are more acidic than alcohols or water. As a matter of fact, phenols have a pH in the range of 5.5 to 6, and this pH range makes them perfect to act as a bactericide. And why that works is something we'll mention when we get to the study of amino acids and proteins. But they are slightly acidic, and having a significant acidity makes them then able to kill bacteria, good bactericides. Maybe that's part of what's in your hand sanitizer. Phenols are very soluble in water. Now think about the structure. Why are they soluble in water? Yeah, hydrogen bonding, of course. And their boiling points are higher than the boiling point of benzene. Remember, benzene is the 6-carbon ring, the aromatic structure. Well, why are the boiling point of phenols higher than the boiling point of benzene? Hydrogen bonding again, that's right. Benzene cannot hydrogen bond to another benzene molecule. Let's look briefly at thiols. Now, the structure of thiols is interesting. Thiols are alcohol-like, if you will, But instead of having an oxygen in there, we have a sulfur. For example, instead of having methanol, like this right here, which is the alcohol, we would have methane thiol. In other words, where there was an oxygen in the alcohol, we have a sulfur in the thiol. Thiols also are often called by another name, and that is mercaptans. They are also known as mercaptans. So remember that.
Beware of the black and white kitty cat. Now, I know that a lot of them are tame and have had their glands removed that allow them to spray such an obnoxious odor. But the wild ones are a little less predictable. And perhaps you should be aware of them. Remember, one of the most potent and pervasive and unpleasant odors known is the skunk odor. What is the odor of skunk? There it is. It's a thiol. Thiols are that class of compounds very closely related to alcohols, but thiols have a nasty habit of smelling awful. As a matter of fact, their odor is so strong and so potent that we use them sometimes to warn us against things that could be dangerous. For example, if you have natural gas in the house and you turn the gas on, do you notice that really unpleasant odor? Well, quite frankly, natural gas has virtually no odor at all. But when we mix a little methane thiol with it, it has a very pungent, unpleasant odor that alerts us to danger. It's a good practical application of one of the many organic compounds.
Well, what about this? Know what this is? Some people think it doesn't smell so bad. This is garlic. Garlic is also a thiol, a very strong, pungent odor, but certainly more pleasant than the odor of a skunk, huh? The smallest thiol, methane thiol, is now being added to natural gas because natural gas, or methane, CH4, really does not have much of an odor, if any. And so we can't detect it. So it is for safety's sake, methane thiol is being added to natural gas so that you can smell the natural gas leak very easily. And it's kind of hard to stay in a room where there's a heavy natural gas leak. That is a safety consideration. Thiols can't undergo hydrogen bonding. They don't have hydrogen bonded to an oxygen. They have hydrogen bonded to a sulfur. Therefore, they have lower boiling points than their corresponding alcohols. They are less soluble in water than alcohols are. And, oh woe is us, they evaporate more easily because they're not bonded to each other as well. They're not attracted to each other as well. So they go off as a gas more easily and go right to our nose where we can detect them. Yes, they are likely to be something we can smell more easily than we can smell an alcohol. Ethers. The structure of ethers is like this, because ethers have the basic formula ROR. So you have an alkyl group attached to an oxygen attached to an alkyl group. Kind of like water, isn't it? And the geometry is very similar to that of water, but there are significant differences, and we must note those. Here's an example of an ether. This is dimethyl ether, if you will, or methyl ether. Notice, unlike water, there's no hydrogen bonded to oxygen in these ethers. The hydrogens are bonded to carbons. And since there is no hydrogen bonded to oxygen, ethers do not have what? Yeah. Can they form hydrogen bonds with each other? No. Why not? Because they don't have hydrogen bonded to oxygen. Well, what does this say about their boiling points? Oh, they're going to boil very, very easily. I have had students carry around a flask of certain ethers in their hand, and the ether was boiling right there, just simply from the heat from their hand. Ethers are very, very volatile. They evaporate very readily. Remember that. It's a very important property of ethers. Can they form hydrogen bonds with water? Well, yeah, they ought to be able to. Look, here's a water molecule, and there's a hydrogen bond. So what does this say about their solubility in water? That's right. They are very soluble in water. Very soluble in water. Can they form hydrogen bonds with alcohols? Well, here's the ether structure. And let's see. I think so. Let's look and see. Oh, here's an alcohol, ethyl alcohol. And look, there's your hydrogen bond. That's right. They can form hydrogen bonds easily with alcohols. So what does this say about their solubility in alcohols? Oh, yes. It is very, very good. Do ethers still play an important role in anesthesia? Well, yes, they do. But it's not the ether of yesteryear. There are several halogenated ethers that are not nearly as flammable as ethyl ether, but they are highly effective, and they don't seem to have some of the unpleasant side effects that the ethyl ether has. For example, here's one. Now notice all of the halogens. Notice all the fluorine on there and the chlorine on there. Yes. This is etherine or enfluorine. And here's another one. Notice the fluorine and the chlorine on here. This is called fluorine or isofluorine. And there are many others. We've been able to design a number of molecules that will have these hypnotic properties, if you will, or these amnesiac properties that work very effectively. It's part of the whole business of drug design, that halogenated materials very often will act as anesthesias. Let's talk about the nomenclature of ethers. And let's start with the nomenclature of what we call symmetrical ethers. Now here's a symmetrical ether. A symmetrical ether has two of the same thing attached to oxygen. The two groups are the same. That makes them symmetrical. Now, what do we have attached to oxygen here? The answer is we have methyl. That's right. So this is dimethyl ether. Dimethyl ether. Well, what about this one? Yes, diethyl ether. This is the ether that used to be used in anesthesia. Here's another ether. What is it? Well, what are the groups that are attached? Well, they're cyclohexyl groups, aren't they? Yeah. So this is dicyclohexyl ether. Now, you didn't get the cyclohexyl confused with this, did you? Yeah. This is diphenyl ether. Diphenyl ether. Let's look at nomenclature of unsymmetrical ethers now. Here we have an unsymmetrical ether. The two groups attached to the oxygen are definitely different. So just name one group, then name the other group, and then name ether. And you kind of run it together. This is methyl ethyl ether. Methyl ethyl ether. What might this be? How about cyclohexyl ethyl ether? Or you could just as easily say ethyl cyclohexyl ether. And this one? Well, how about phenyl cyclohexyl ether? Or, if you will, cyclohexyl phenyl ether. Yes, the nomenclature is very straightforward for these. The reactions of ether. They are extremely flammable. Be very careful with them. Exert great caution. And they tend to form highly unstable peroxides, particularly the diethyl ether. When the diethyl ether is exposed to air, it can form peroxides that are explosive. And there are a number of cases in the history of anesthesia in which the diethyl ether was being used as an anesthesia in the surgical suite, and somebody slammed a door and the can of diethyl ether exploded. You have to be careful. Otherwise, they're chemically very stable. Wow, we've covered some interesting topics in this unit, haven't we? We've talked about alcohols, remember, primary, secondary, and tertiary. We talked about phenols and the fact that phenols, which look like aromatic alcohols, are in fact not alcohols at all. We talked about thiols, and you'll probably never forget garlic and skunk, where thiols are concerned. And we talked about ethers, yes, a better way to teach and learn chemistry.